So, for this morning's talk, continuing on a theme, but also bringing in more understanding of the power of meditation and the path of meditation, is when we have even the mindfulness training of the four satipatthanas, as many people get used to, even there, sometimes just change one of the focuses of mindfulness, one of the four. Because we do have the first, the mindfulness of the body. And the second one is usually called mindfulness of feelings. But the feelings is a word in English which has such a wide meaning. It can be emotional experience, it can be just the objects of the sense of physical touch. But to me it was not really adequate to actually describe what the thing really means. And it starts to discuss the feelings for any one of the six senses, sight, hearing, smell, taste, touch, and mind, as a separate sense. And to describe them, whether they're pleasant, unpleasant, or somewhere in between. But it really wasn't the quality of the experience, no more than watching the breath and thinking that long or short is the most important thing you're supposed to be observing. It is the breath you're experiencing in the breath meditation, not the length or the shortness of it. And in the second satipatthana, it is not the pleasantness or the unpleasantness or the in-between which one is focusing on. It is this experience itself, what it's like. What is it to see? What is it to hear? What is hearing? What is smelling, tasting? What is physical touch? You know, what is sort of knowing? So it's knowing those experiences, getting to understand them. And the way we understand them is by just staying with them long enough for them to reveal their secrets. It's almost like a scientific paradigm where you just observe, 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 observe until you have enough data you can understand how these things work. But before you go deeper into the stillness, into the experience, it's all of these things, in order to get these pesky five hindrances subdued, because they always tend to get in the way, either with fear or ill will or sort of wanting, that we have this wonderful process of stilling, of causing some calm and peace. And that is, you know, the job of the last of the eight factors, samadhi. And that is, you know, one of it's the last part of the Eightfold Path, and it is crucial to actually understanding things, and it has all sorts of amazing byproducts. It's not just becoming enlightened, it's also just getting understanding, getting some power, getting some freedom from the passions of the body, and getting some health. And obviously getting some really nice understandings of the nature of this world and what lies beyond. So that stillness is the understanding of samadhi. And I think you've heard me say this so many times, when we translate that word as concentration, oh, that just causes so much problems in the meditating world. And of all the translation, that was the most troublesome, simply because concentration, you know what that means from school and from work and from every other part of your life, concentrate. And concentrate is what you try to achieve through willpower. It just makes you tired. And even just this morning, just as I was in the office just before coming in here, even there was article from Harvard Business School. Was that Harvard one? Or there's two articles I just quickly read. And they said that willpower doesn't cut it. If you try and achieve things by willpower, do you find out you just eventually fail? That you just give up and you get tired and frustrated? But if you enjoy what you're doing, if you have fun doing it, then you can stay with it for a long period of time. It's a wonderful wisdom power, especially when you have joy with what you do. If you enjoy, say, playing chess, you can actually focus, concentrate. It's not concentration, it's no effort. You're just, you know, interested in the game. Just like whenever I used to do my math homework, it wasn't work. It was like puzzles. And I enjoyed doing those puzzles. It was just recreation. It wasn't sort of work for me because I enjoyed it. Even like teaching or meditating. Meditating is not work. It's fun. I enjoy this. Because of that, you don't need to concentrate. And as the Buddha put it, I've mentioned this once already, but I'll emphasize it here, is that when the mind finds joy and happiness and fun in whatever it wants to do, the mind actually leaps to it. It's like taking your dog out for exercise in the morning. The dog doesn't need to be dragged, you know, on the leash and dragged out of the door. The dog wants to go, it enjoys just having a bit of exercise and running around and sniffing everything. So this is where the joy is the key to focusing and stillness and peace, to samadhi, not concentration. So what we're doing is we are aware, and we're using that awareness and the joy and the wisdom to see how we can delve deeper into the nature of our body, our minds, and the nature of happiness. Sometimes that we can say that we are Buddhists, we practice to overcome suffering. Yeah, overcoming suffering. But what is overcoming suffering? It's just experiencing happiness and joy. Because if you understand suffering, you really get to know it, you can let it go and go beyond. When you understand just how heavy weights we keep carrying, and of course, after a while, we let it go. And this is the stick simile from Ajahn Chah, that fortunately there's no monk sitting next to me. What he would do to teach, and most of Ajahn Chah's best teachings just came from one-liners. You know, when he was walking with you, in this particular time, he was walking when I was on arms round, I was carrying his bowl, and he stooped and picked up a stick, and then it's when he said, "Is the stick heavy?" And before I could answer, he threw the stick away, saying it's only heavy when you hold it. You don't need to hold it. The stick can be thrown away. And then it's light. Simple things like that. It's happy to be light and carry few burdens through your day, through your life. And so the sign of letting go, the sign of wisdom, is a happiness. That shows that there's something actually happening. And to this day, when people come for interviews, I'm saying all my tricks now, but why not? When people come for interviews and they say how deep their meditation is, I only half listen to what you're saying. Because what I really do, I look at your face and your facial expression, especially your smile, and just the openness, the lightness of your facial features. And the more happy you are, the more relaxed you are, the more I know that no matter what you say, you've just had some nice meditations, some deep meditations. And the classic case was some years ago, this gentleman came up to me in one of the earlier retreats and said, oh, it's just a very difficult retreat this time. He said, I've only got second jhana, I just can't get to the third jhana. And it's just so... And basically, I couldn't say it to him, it really upset him. But I said to him, no, that's not second jhana, it's not even first jhana, it's not even close. If you just had a second jhana, oh, you'd be blissed out. You could see it all over your face, this stupid, silly smile on your face. And you're just so happy, so peaceful, so wonderful after you come out. So it is that, the happiness part of it, the joy. It's not only just the afterglow of a deep meditation, it's part of the meditation. And it's what allows you to stay in that meditation. The joy, the happiness, the peace of it. So, with that overview, I'm now going to go back to just the basic method of meditation. You're sitting down, and you relax your body. And it does not matter how you're sitting, as though you're laying down or whatever you're up to, as long as you feel the body comfortable. But how do you get your body comfortable? There's always an ache here, a pain there, and especially you get older. And actually, just younger, just there's always some ache or pain somewhere. So what you do is you be aware of your body. And the awareness of the body is actually really, you'd say, awareness of physical feelings in the body. The experience of the sense of touch. So I start the meditation, I experience, how is my body right now? And in meditation, in Buddhism, again, we never allow the theory, the learning, the teachings to stand in the way of truth, which is our personal experience right now. So I'm not in full lotus, bad Ajahn Brahm. So no, but this feels good. So you try and feel what is the best for you in this moment. And you're sensitive enough to your body, you can actually feel it. And you get to know your body. Your body is just like this really good friend. And if you've got a good friend, of course I've never been married, I've had relationships before I was a monk. But if you live with someone for long enough, you get to be sensitive to her. I mean, know exactly how she's feeling. When's the right time to say this, and when's the right time to keep your mouth shut? You know, I think all of you who've been in relationships know that. And so you know. And that's like the relationship I have to my body. It's like my mind is married to my body for all these years, and I've got to learn how to deal with it, because if I don't deal with it wisely, my body throws a tantrum. In other words, it gets sick, doesn't want to cooperate. So I learn, what does my body need? When does it want to sleep? How much? What does it want to eat? How much it wants to eat? And just gently get to know my body and just what keeps it comfortable and healthy and what makes it work. And so you get to know your body. And when you start to get to know your physical body, it becomes very easy to understand the experiences. Second Satipatthana. And what causes them to arise, and what causes them to disappear. That rise and fall thing, which I already said in the Satipatthana, is not things coming and going. It is actually things, why does this pain happen? Why does this comfort occur? What causes it? But in order to know the cause and effect of physical comfort and health, we've got to observe, first of all. Observe, 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 just to be with it. And this is where we get this wonderful, very useful phenomena of feedback. I'm watching my body, experiencing it, and then sometimes I relate to it this way, I relate to it another way, and it has different effects. If I'm afraid of my body, I'm afraid of the things that it might do, like fall asleep or snore during meditation, then of course that fear will make me very, very tense. You know, sometimes that monks would actually, when they were very sleepy, they would sit right on the edge of like the platform, knowing that if they started wobbling too much, they would fall over. And I remember in the early years in Wat Pa Phong and the branch monasteries, after the range retreat had finished, when there was many katina ceremonies we would go to, then the monks would be giving sermons, you know, one after the other throughout the night. Ajahn Chah's was worth listening to, but some of the others were so boring. And he also had these little novices there as well. And the novices had to sit up and listen to it. And then every now and again, the monk next to me would to jab me in the arms, say, "Look at that one over there, he's going to go soon." Because they started wobbling more and more and more. And it was just the little bit of excitement which the monks would have. It'd only be a few minutes, and then he'd topple. And you'd see everything. Because it's the robes. And the lay people, too. You know, you'd look at them. And they were also looking at that little novice, poor thing. Because they were bored with the sermons. That was a little entertainment. But anyway, so that some of the monks would actually take that even further. There was that monastery in Laos just before the was taken over by the communists. It was a very well-known, famous monastery. And there they would take the monks, the abbot there would take the new monks on a walk up the mountains through the forest, and it was just hot, it was just very, a lot of exertion, all day. After the morning meal, they walk here, walk there, and then eventually they'd come to this clearing in the forest, in the jungles, where there was these beautiful tall trees, magnificent, I don't know what species, but very tall. And the monks had built platforms just the size of these mats high up on the branches. And there were bamboo ladders to get up. So the abbot, the teacher, would send his monks one by one, each to a different platform. And once they were on top, you know, so many tens, hundreds of meters above the ground, then he would take the ladder away and so be back in the morning. And apparently, many monks got great meditation up there, at least the ones who lived to tell the tale. Because you couldn't be sleepy, you'd fall off and you'd die. If you didn't die after you falling down, you'd be tiger fruit. Either way, you know, there's no survival possible. But that's what they used to do. At first when I heard that, it's really tough, I'm going to do that. But then I thought, hang on, be realistic, Ajahn Brahm. You'll probably be tiger food too. So instead, you know, we realize that force, that willpower, or fear power, that must be another way than that. So instead, you start to get to know your body. You know, what is tiredness? What is all this fear and this willpower? So you learn from your body, first of all, how your body works. And so often, I've told so many stories, but like this, okay, this is the classic story, because it's one of the most impressive, is when I had the food poisoning episode. I'll do it in brief, because if I tell this story in the evening, when people are a bit tired, I usually give it a lot of drama. I said, "You had food poisoning." And of course, as soon as I act out, the realistic, the cramps in the body, it wakes people up and makes them interested. Because, you know, I am a pretty sort of well-known teacher. One of the reasons is that I've used feedback. You know, I watch you when I give talks. And if you're down here somewhere, you know, and just fiddling with things, I realize that it's a time for, and that grabs your attention. But anyway, the true story was that in the cave, my cave on the opposite side of the road, and just having very bad food poisoning, you know, it's just an automatic response. The body cramps, it's extremely painful, and just the body just screams. And just, what to do? And fortunately, that, you know, you have learnt so much meditation over the years, having great teachers, and so, no problem. Right with the extreme feelings of pain. With them. Now is the most important time, the only time I have. This moment is the most important. And you care for that feeling. The mindfulness gives you feedback. In other words, as I'm watching that pain, it gets less or it gets worse. Why? I joined the dots. I found out the why. This is classic second Satipatthana practice. Awareness of feelings, why they come up this way, why they disappear. And you find out for yourself. I can say these things, but the words only give a fraction of the information. They just point you in the right direction. You just go look over there and you'll find what I mean. What you find out is that when you react with fear, with control, with wanting, with ill will, with anything which is a negative doing, then you find out it gets worse, it tenses up. And the pain gets increased. But when you have loving kindness, open the door of my heart to this moment, just being here, being with it, not fighting it, making peace with it, being kind to it, just being gentle, being patient. You either get better or you'll die. Ajahn Chah's great teaching, but not as a joke. You know, it's never going to last. And after a while of trying this and trying that, especially the kindness, and even the kindness, you know the word kindness? You can spell metta, you can chant the Metta Sutta, but do you know what metta actually is? And that was a wonderful thing. So many of these ideas and concepts and words in Dhamma, we think we know, but then can we apply it? And it's in the use of these ideas, these ways of relating, that we find out whether we do really understand what metta is. Because when I put metta on my pain, I know that's metta, because the whole thing just relaxes. And the tightness subsides. It starts to relax. Relax to the max is the effect. Metta is actually the agent which actually creates the relaxing to the max. So you feel the metta and just the thing relaxes. The pain gets less. The tightness eases. The stress on the guitar string starts to loosen. And you can feel that. Your mindfulness is not trying to escape. It's investigating. It's with this area. It's exploring it. And so little by little, you learn how to relax your own body. And that was wonderful. Yeah, I remember at the time, it actually surprised me just how quick you could do this. I mean, it was 20 minutes of just meditating, but then all the screaming stopped. And all of the pain went, and there was nothing left. It was just ordinary stomach. And I know enough about science, and this is weird. Now, where did the bacteria go? Anyway, so they find out how you can relax the body. An ache in the knee. You can feel it. Open it up. Relax it, not fight it, and see it. Often just relax away. So what you're doing there, you're learning a lot about your body and what the Buddha said. And you sort of, after finding these things out yourself because of good teachers, from good teachers, then you start looking back at the suttas where the Buddha said there is the two thorns or the two darts, the mental and the physical. And the physical dart You can't do too much about it. That's having a body. You have aches and pains, colds and coughs, and all sorts of other sort of experiences, both positive and negative. But the mental one, you have full power over. How you react. How you react to difficulties and problems and physical pain and disappointments in life. You can have full power over that. You can let it go. You let it be. And the worst part of the pain vanishes. So it's not a problem anymore. And this is a great help to people who have chronic pain. I don't know why now, many more people say that they have chronic pain, it's all the time. I'm not quite sure what the pathology of that is and what the physical problem is, but there are some times that people can take away the mental negative reaction. They can have a wonderful life with the pain, in spite of it. And for many, you would not know. They're in extreme pain. One of those gentlemen, I don't know ever what happened to him, but this was so many years ago, but he said that he was a sufferer of great pain, and he used to go to the Osborne Park Pain Clinic, that's just to the west of Nollamara, and he said that they had CT scans which could actually see just a part of the brain which was active, which showed the people that an objective standard for how much pain he was feeling constantly. So I know we can also say it hurts, but how much? And how do we know that my pain, your pain is the same, or mine is more extreme, or mine more less than yours? It's so hard to have an objective measure for pain. But apparently with CT scans, they can have a pretty good objective measure. And that helped him communicate to his friends and colleagues and family what he was feeling. And they had these very graphic standards of pain. So when he said he was hurting, you really understood how much he was hurting, an objective standard. And what he said the doctors, the nurses, the experts there, he had that standard of pain which was the same as having your arm cut off with a saw. He said that's what he was feeling continuously. If you cut your hand off with a saw, your arm with a saw, no anesthetic, that was the same lighting up of that part of the brain which he had all the time. So that's graphic. I said, wow, how do you deal with that? And you saw him, just so peaceful, because he came with a big smile on his face. I remember this little anecdote. He came with a big smile on his face, saying, I've finally done it. And I knew he was a meditator. He had to meditate because of that extreme pain. That's how he was dealing with the problem, to be able to live a life, understanding his mental reactions, and reacting appropriately. And he said he finally did it, and I thought, aha, you probably got the ECG flat, because when you get very deep in meditation, just the heartbeat can get so soft you can't even discern it. And he looked at me with a cheeky smile and said, oh, I did that weeks ago. No, the EEG, I've got that flat now. And he turned around and said, see all those people in the back? Those are some of the doctors and nurses from the hospital trying to figure out what the hell's going on with this meditation business. And I've got no reason to doubt him. There's some amazing things which were happening there because he had to. So, your pain, your discomfort, can we really relax it? You can't do that through willpower. You try willpower and it just gets tighter and more painful. You can endure that for a while. You can suppress it. You can put it under a rock and sit on that rock, but that rock is going to explode soon. So what you do, this wonderful understanding the reaction we have to pain. We learn that through the feedback. So that feels much better. And I get afraid of it, and it feels much worse. So, we're learning how the mind interacts with the physical feelings. And so what happens then? We can relax our body. And our body gets still. Still in the sense of calm down, even, peaceful. Because that's what samatha means. Everything gets still and even, and then it vanishes. The word samatha, like I mentioned the word anicca, is used in the Buddhist code of conduct, in how we settle disputes and business in the Sangha. So we have some discussion about what's allowable in the afternoon or evening. Cheese or chocolate or what type of cheese and blah, blah, blah. And so what we have to do, or there's an argument about Dhamma or some discussion in the Sangha. So what we do is that we find a resolution to settle the matter, to calm it down, so it's not something which is active and bubbling anymore. It's settled. It's calmed. The matter is resolved. It may not have a firm conclusion, a decision of certainty, but it's enough that we don't bother with it anymore. It's not a problem. That is called samatha. The thing is calmed, it's settled, it's samatted. So when we do samatha on our body, we are settling the problems and difficulties and disturbances in our body. So the body can be peaceful and still and comfortable. So that's what we always have to start with, looking at our body and calming it down. The result of samatha, when the things start to settle down, there's a lot of joy and delight. In the same way that when you're arguing or looking through the books and using your logic and reason, why can't I have this in the afternoon? No, other monasteries have this in the afternoon, and this place doesn't have it. This is really unfair. We should have this, but no, that's too lax. We should be more strict. We're into getting nibbana. We're the tough people. But no, we have to be compassionate. You can see just how that creates a lot of disturbance. And sometimes we think, if we can find the real answer, the black and white solution, then we can actually have resolution. And that's why I started studying the Vinaya, because I thought there is a solution. One thing is true, the other thing is false. Welcome to life. It's not that way at all. Depends which way you look at it. Depends how you want to regard it. You know, it's just a good lawyer can actually probably get you fish and chips in the afternoon if you if they understood the opinion that well. So that's not the point. So the point is, yes, okay, this is good enough, and settle it, calm it down, so you don't have to think about it. That's the other interesting thing about life as a monk or life teaching. If we did settle it, so it's quite clear that this is what you can eat, this is what you can't eat, then people find something else to bring up. People are addicted to drama. In other words, if your life was very peaceful, we've got to do something to stir it up. It's amazing just how much we like problems. You might think, oh no, 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 I just want peace. Yeah, sure. You give yourself some peace, you know, I'm going to stir this up and create a problem. You do it, you don't even realize you're doing it. And the convincing argument for that is that if you're having a peaceful life, what do? Turn on the television and listen to a drama somewhere. Apparently the most popular drama is Game of Thrones, whatever that is. But not maybe for you, but I keep looking in the newspaper or something and they're all talking about it. And in the cartoons, it's even the cartoons as well, Game of Thrones, whatever that is. But anyway, why do people want to worry about fantasy world? You know what's going to happen in the end. Listen, over the hero suddenly wins and runs away or rides off into the sunset, you know, with their partner, living happily ever after. Is that what happens? Until the next episode. And then something goes wrong with it. Why do people get obsessed with drama? And even you're having a peaceful life, we make drama in our own life. It's like a psychological inclination of human beings. Just like, what is it, nature abhors a vacuum. That human beings, human society, does not like contentment. They always stir it up with dramas. Crazy, but that's our inclinations. So, calming things down. And there is a great delight in a calm body. And that's one of the things which surprised me years ago. Really mindful of my body, relaxing it, and even 68 years of age, 68 years, 67, or something around that. You know, the body should be aching and should be sickly and just tired, but sometimes you relax it to the max and you feel it's so delightful. It's a pleasure. And being a monk, the first thing you think, oh no, you can't get into pleasure, you know, just that you get attached, blah, blah, blah. But then I thought, no, I'm going to explore the pleasure of my body. Just now, sitting here perfectly still, just feeling this beautiful, relaxed delight in the body. And what happens is when I notice the delight of a relaxed body, the body got more relaxed. It's the delight allowed my attention to stay there. It wasn't forced. It wasn't focused using willpower. It just felt good. So I just carried on, just being with this wonderful body. And then it got even more deeply relaxed. And another little understanding of the jigsaw, the power that delight has to create stillness and calm things down. And of course, when your body is that still and relaxed, it vanishes. I've done the job of relaxing the body. And then you go off to your mind and do what we call part of the third satipatthana. It's only a weak form of the third satipatthana. Mindfulness of the mind. Not in the sense it's in jhanas yet, but you notice if the mind has got agitation or whether it's got peace, whether it's got sloth and torpor, or whether it's got clarity, whether it wants something. You don't understand the five hindrances. You're calm enough by this place that you can actually see pretty well. But the one which I really focus on is just how agitated I am or how peaceful I am inside. And this is where I just invented the peace-ometer. Okay, so it's just a pretty silly word, but I don't know what else to call it. Because speedometer, thermometer, and all these other meters which we have. And so the speedometer, in this particular case, the peaceometer, it was a measure of how peaceful I was in my mind, how calm, how content, or how agitated I was. And so after a while, you get to know that. You get to be very familiar with your peaceometer. So how peaceful are you now? How agitated are you? Or you can look at one other, like the tired ometer or the energized ometer. So all these are important parts of your mind. And if you're having trouble with sloth and torpor and stuff like that, just how tired are you now? Is it normal tiredness, or more than usual, or less than usual? Which is why, you know, just giving some recognition for our modern lifestyle, we always give it a scale of numbers, unfortunately. Like, what stage of meditation are you? 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6. I hate those numbers when comparing, but that's the way we live. So, how many days of the meditation have we done so far? How many days left? There's more numbers. So instead of looking at numbers, you know, just say, all we have is now. It's great for meditation. But when it comes to peaceometer, give it a scale, 1 to 10. Your tiredometer, how tired are you now, from 1 to 10? 1 is, you know, you're almost asleep. 10 is you're bright and energized, fully awake. What number have you got right now? And because you don't have to tell anybody, it's your personal data. This is not Facebook or Google. Your personal data. But now, what makes you more alive? More awake? What makes you more tired? You find the causes and effects. Once you find out what makes you more alive, more awake, then make yourself more awake. Go out there and just get some fresh air. Go out there and do some meditation on the walking paths. If the meditation doesn't wake you up, do backwards walking meditation. Walk backwards. And then without hitting the wall, that will keep you really awake. I hope. Whatever it is, you do sort of innovate, experiment, trial and error, and you find out what makes you awake. And of course, that's where, you know, I found out that if I try to do this, to do that, to try and keep awake, doesn't work. Too much effort. So I just decided I'm going to be kind. Nothing wrong with being sleepy. My sleep quotient was about 1 and a bit maybe. So I was just tired. But I was enough aware to notice seeing that number just increase. The needle start to move up the less I did. Just sitting there, waiting, patient, kind, content, not demanding in nature, easily satisfied with my sleepiness. What happened? The needle started moving up. This is weird. I'm not doing anything. I'm not striving. I'm not trying to get rid of stuff. I'm just being here. And you wake up. And you don't stop when you just got ordinary wakefulness. You just, hey, this is really good. Don't do anything, just watch, just be here. And then the needle goes even higher and higher and higher. And soon it's up to close to 10. Sometimes it goes to 11 off the scale. And that's when you see so much beauty in this world. Fully awake, alive, seeing all the, hearing all the sounds of the birds. And it's just delightful with that type of energy. And you know where it comes from. And it's the same with your peaceometer. Maybe in here, you know, it's more like the sleepometer or the wakeometer, which you're looking at. Give it your own name. And then when you're really awake, you find again it's exactly the same, just making peace, not fighting, being kind. Not trying to improve, not trying to judge, or, you know, put yourself down because you're always sleepy. You're just there. And you're awake, 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 awake. And then you've got nice mindfulness. And it's at that point, once we've established mindfulness as a priority, is the translation which I always give for the Anapanasati. We start off, before we even start watching the breathing, people say to establish mindfulness in front of you. In front of you. What the heck does that mean? When there's no you there anyway, in front of what? But people think, well, you know, where do you exist? Where are you located? For many people, they're in their head. So I say, oh, mindfulness in front of my head. What's in front of my head? My nose. Aha, mindfulness in the nose. What about mindfulness of your belly, the belly meditation? How can that be mindfulness in front of you? Unless you're really hungry and you live most of your attention down here. It doesn't mean mindfulness in front of a person. It means the literal word is so similar to the English word giving it priority, putting it first, putting in front. The first person who takes the food in the line. The first priority. So you make mindfulness the priority, the first thing on your list to do. Put it in front. Purakata. That's what it means. So once you have mindfulness, get your mindfulness strong. First of all, relax the body. Peaceometer, and okay, you've got enough mindfulness now. Now, even just invite the breath in, if you want to watch the breath. Usually it comes anyway. And it's so easy. Once you've established enough mindfulness first, what most people do, oh, they say, no, okay, sitting down, come watch the breath. That's an exaggeration. But that's what most, you can't maintain that, not by willpower. That's why your mind goes wandering off and bringing it back. It's not ready to watch the breath yet. You're just trying something which will never work. Okay, sometimes you can really put willpower, real willpower, just really be strong. Come on, watch it, I'm going to watch my breath. Don't move away. You can't maintain that very long. It's unpleasant, it's tight, the joy is absent. So instead, we use this wonderful relaxing first. And then the breath is just there. Just watching the breath go in, and it's always just so peaceful and nice when I watch it, having developed enough mindfulness first of all. I've calmed everything down. I am ready to watch my breathing. And that was such a great understanding and to share with you. Sometimes you sit down, you're not ready to watch your breath. You're just wasting your time. You're getting frustrated. And you come out saying, I can't meditate. There's not a person in this world who can't meditate. If you know how to do it. So you all can. It's just sometimes we get the wrong instructions or we just don't listen. So here, relax the body. And you can sit on a chair, you can get one of these lazy boys, you know, just the little, you press a button here and the chair goes out. I often thought of that, I fantasized about why do we always have to have these old-fashioned meditation cushions, Zafus. This is the 21st century. Can't we have high-tech meditation cushions? And that's when I started to fantasize about designing my own meditation cushion company. So, you know, you could have, first of all, because people like different temperatures. So you can adjust the temperature. You know, you can have like heated meditation cushions. Because I've been in these toilets in Japan and Korea, you just press the button and the toilet seat warms. Somebody gets too hot, but you know, The first time, I'm a bit of a sort of a kid who hasn't grown up. Sometimes people say, because sometimes I press this button. What does that do? Press this button. The first time you see one of these high-tech top. But anyway, why can't you sort of have little compartments in your cushion? So you press another button, and that fills with air just to lift your bottom up, if you need that up, one on the side. If that's too high, just you can lower it, and they can have it. And it can be warm, it can be cool. And what a wonderful thing is another button, and you have like a little cup there, and you can have your coffee without getting out. Just put it up there, and just, do you want latte? Do you want sort of soya milk? Or oh. Wouldn't that be the high-class, high-tech meditation cushions? But anyway, the point is just to get yourself comfortable and find out just how to make it peaceful. And you delight in this beautiful, relaxed body. And you get peaceful. And you delight in a peaceful mind. If you were, all of you, I think, by now, gone for a walk in the forest, or just sitting out with a cup of tea on the veranda, just sunning yourself. Do you feel the delight? Just doing nothing, nothing to do. You're not even drinking your tea, you're just watching the trees grow, just watching the birds flitter through the sky, just watch the clouds. It's delightful peace. So please notice the delight and indulge in it. Peacefulness is so delightful. Oh, I can take more of this. Because then what happens when you come and meditate? You're peaceful and you watch the breath. Sabai. Sabai. And the breath is delightful. And sometimes you hear those sound of the birds. They're not distractions at all. They're part of Sabai. And then the breath gets so peaceful. What's happening is you are becoming still. Samatha, you're calming everything down. The birds can never distract you. Your reaction to that sound is what distracts you and causes the problems. The world outside is pretty peaceful here. But the way we respond to it, blooming birds, I'm just about to get enlightened, and that crow again, ga, 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 ga. Can't we do something about the crows? But of course, you know, you can see just how that affects your peacefulness. You just let it be. It's so still and peaceful that then the breath starts to disappear. Stillness is what allows things to vanish. Your attachments, your baggage, your burdens, your afflictions start to vanish little by little. The thing you are worried about and obsessed with, afraid of, hey, it's not there. Where's it gone? It disappears in spite of you. This is a wonderful thing. Hey, where did that go? People sometimes have tinnitus, constant ache or pain, heat, and it's, hey, it's weird, it's gone. Why? Because you're really calming down. When things become still, they disappear. That is the wonderful path of meditation. This is where samadhi, sometimes it leads to viraga. And again, another silly translation. Yeah, it can mean dispassion, but it also means fading away. Everybody knows it has those two meanings, but why do they always call it sort of dispassion? And the main meaning is things disappearing, fading away, until nirodha. It sees, it's disappeared, it's gone. Which is really nice. So, when you understand that this leads to fading away, when there's nothing left, it's so beautiful to have no burdens. When things are just gone, disappeared, body's gone. Ooh! Past and future, all gone. Not because you've chased them away, because the present moment is just too delightful. The breath. It's delightful, just watching the breath. So peaceful, so rewarding, just nice, sabai. And afterwards the breath disappears. You don't do anything. What happens is a physical experience of the breath. The breath is experienced through the fifth sense of touch. It gets so light. Now you experience the breath through the sixth sense, through the mind. It is, as I said yesterday, a citta sankhara. So experience is really delightful, very pleasurable. Just like all these other things I've been saying, that just whether it's a piece of feces in the toilet, whether it's to see a world in a grain of sand, a heaven in a wildflower, whether it's looking at the hillside when you're very calm, it's just so gorgeous. In the stillness, the delight increases. And so really you're seeing the breath, but with the mind. It's beautiful. And the breath becomes so delightful. Breathing in, breathing out, until the delight just is what takes over. You're blissing out. Ecstasy. Great joy. And that is how we usually experience these lights and images. These lights come up at other times, but this is the big ones. Gorgeous. Wow. We don't say wow, please, because that disturbs it. When these images come up, exciting, powerful, sometimes afraid. And one of the similes for that is this... He was a husband of one of the Thai ladies who comes and gives the food regularly. And he was a photographer for the Sunday Times newspaper in Perth. And it's not exactly a high-class sort of publication. But anyway, his editor said to him, there was a rumour, just a rumour going around, that the Australian pop singer Kylie Minogue had a breakdown and that she was hiding out in Cable Beach Resort up in Broome. So the editor said, do you want to go and find out whether it's true or not? And of course, a free trip up to Cable Beach, the resort, you know, it's one of the most beautiful parts of the world. So he took that one. So he took his camera up and with the most exciting assignment he ever had. Because, you know, if she was up there, you know, the people at the front desk wouldn't say. So he went round the back and just climbed over the fence and crept through the bushes with his camera, just in case she might be there. And creeping through the bushes, he saw this small petite woman by one of the chalets. So he took out his camera, his telephoto lens, whatever. And he looked, it was her. It was a scoop of his career. This is a true story. Ethically, it was not that good. But nevertheless, I use this as a simile for Nimitus. Because he had to be just so quiet. He couldn't shout or be excited because she would know there's a paparazzi about to shoot her. And so she put up the camera. Click. He got the photograph. And I am partially responsible for that. Because all that meditation training, without that, he wouldn't have been able to calm down and take the photo. But that's what it's like, you know, when you have beautiful nimittas, great states of mind coming up. You've got to be very calm. Otherwise, the nimitta will realize that you're about to shoot the nimitta and get a photograph of it. And so it will run away. So you're just so calm and peaceful. And then just the lights just stay there. Get more and more gorgeous, more and more beautiful. More and more delightful. But if you want it, it will go. Even a small amount of wanting makes the mind shake. You're aware of that, you can see it. And it all means a bit of training. You get the feedback. When you want it, the mind shakes. When you're excited, it really shakes in. But when you just leave it alone, calm, samatha, the light gets stronger and stronger and stronger. Now, again, I always hesitate here because I mean, it is the most beautiful experience you can have. Really is pleasure, just immense, blissing out. What is it, that gentleman who was, he was a heroin addict, and really be careful, tell your kids and anyone else you know, apparently just for, not for everybody, it's only a certain number, just one shot of heroin, and you really are hooked for life. People experimenting, and then you're in big trouble, you're hooked. And what that meant was this fellow was just, he's a good man, but because he became addicted, trying so hard to get off, and then so he came to monastery. He wasn't really a Buddhist, but he came to a monastery just to see if he could, you know, just have good support and just be far away from any heroin. And he was doing so well. But then he told me that 100 times a day, 300 times a day, he has to say no. The craving is there. Only has to say yes once, and he's back on the addiction. It's a terrible, terrible drug. But anyway, the reason I tell that story is because once, because he was in big trouble, he just, you know, really took his meditation absolutely seriously, and he came running towards me once as I was about to go into Nolamara, just telling me, he said, I never thought I'd ever say this to anybody. But he said that, you know, you've always said that the joy of these deep meditations is better than sex, better than orgasm. But he said it's heroin is much better than even orgasm. But he said that the bliss of nimittas is even way, way above heroin in the pleasure scale. Well, that's actually how much it's joyful. And I have to take him at his word. I've never had heroin, thank goodness. But that's how powerful these joys are. So, it's scary when you get to these days because you're disappearing. You as you know it, your sense of self, ego, will, all that sort of stuff is going. But it's just too nice to resist. So when it happens, let go. Just carry on, don't interfere with the process. It is like you're going over the cliff. But you won't die. In fact, the most wonderful experience of your life. Samatha. Calm. All coming just from being aware, finding out how to calm yourself down. Experience the beautiful delight of the mind, of the body when it's relaxed, of the mind when it's relaxed, of the breath. It becomes such a natural process, which is one of the reasons why, be patient. It happens. The only thing you can really do is actually interfere and obstruct and slow it down, this process. We do that all the time, and just, you know, just relax, stop, let go. And all these things would occur much, much easier, much sooner. We won't try to hurry it along. We actually impede it. Which is one of the reasons why the right effort is stop interfering with the process. Get out of the way. Butt out, as they would say, the ruder word. And just let the process happen. Sadhu, sadhu, sadhu. Okay, there we go.